This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The planet is cooking, ice vanishes, storms rage. Many countries promise a Green New Deal as a solution. Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, Jeremy Rifkin, and Robert Pollin want one. But is this just another bad old deal for the climate and the natural world? Can it work? Cambridge professor of political economy Jeremy Green investigated the alluring power of past social success in the Great Depression. His open access paper is called Greening Keynes, Productivist Lineages of the Green New Deal. If this is our big shot, we all need to dig into what that really means. Dr. Jeremy Green, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, a fair guess predicts most of our listeners are not economists. Who was John Maynard Keynes, and why is he back in favor in recent times of crisis?
So John Maynard Keynes was a very influential British economist and also a government official who was very influential both in developing modern macroeconomics in the 20th century, in particular in response to the challenges of the Great Depression, but was also central to steering the UK government's response to the financial economic challenges of the First and Second World Wars. So he's a very unique figure in that he's both a profoundly transformative thinker as one of the founders of modern macroeconomics, but also a practitioner, a policymaker who was very much connected to the institutions of power.
In 1999, Time magazine included Keynes in its most important people of the century, saying, quote, his radical idea that governments should spend money they don't have may have saved capitalism, end quote. And that was before 2008, when the U.S. government created a $700 billion bailout fund for Wall Street and General Motors. Now, after the massive COVID support spending, Jeremy, I guess everybody listening has experienced the Keynes revival. True?
So to some extent that is true because, of course, one of Keynes's contributions was to reveal the power of money, the power of monetary and fiscal policy to achieve what is considered socially necessary. So his response to the Great Depression was to say, look, what we actually need to do is sort of unshackle our thinking and our practice of how we use money as a tool to achieve certain economic and social outcomes. We need to break away from the constraints of the gold standard and the idea that we need some kind of precious metal backing for the currency. And instead, we should try and be ambitious in using economic policy and economic tools to meet big social challenges like unemployment and to escape from the perils of depression. And because of his counsel that we need to be creative, imaginative, and to expand the boundaries of economic policy during times of crisis, Keynes has become a popular resource for progressive thinkers as they try and navigate different social and economic challenges. But the problem here, of course, is that Keynes, as you pointed out there, was trying to save capitalism. And if, in fact, capitalism itself is a central driver of climate crisis, then that creates a somewhat paradoxical status for his thought as we try and engage with the problem of green transition.
Well, governments knew large and expensive action was needed to combat climate change and even mass extinction of the species. But the global problem has been approached differently in various countries, and there's been little coordination or awareness of what the other was doing. Most American listeners do not know much about the European Green Deal. Could you give us a quick snapshot of the EU's action there?
So the EU is introducing a number of policies under the name of the EU Green Deal, and this is a framework to accelerate decarbonisation in the European Union, also to progress other ideas about sustainability, about the circularity of goods, thinking about some of the environmental foundations of the economy. But this is also a plan that stops well short of some of the sorts of proposals that we've seen in the more intellectual and academic work on the Green New Deal. So there isn't a commitment to full employment. There isn't a strongly redistributive agenda within the European Green Deal. And much of it is geared towards, in fact, making European industry competitive and putting it into a leading position in the quote-unquote green industries of tomorrow. So trying to promote and support the European Union's journey through decarbonisation in a way that both meets environmental goals but also secures the status of European industry within the global market.
And in America, we have the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and it's broader with climate projects only barely mentioned on the edges. How would you characterize the American bipartisan infrastructure bill? Is it a new Green Deal at all?
I think the legislation that we've seen in the U.S. takes some inspiration from the New Deal and from more recent discussions of the Green New Deal in terms of the emphasis on using the fiscal capacity of governments to support and encourage infrastructure investment, some of which has an environmental focus. But it's also very much a strategy geared towards rebuilding American industrial competitiveness in response to what's perceived as the threat of Chinese advancement in manufacturing and in other high-tech sectors. So there are certainly some environmental imperatives that are quite central to the big policies that Biden has introduced, in particular the Inflation Reduction Act, a little bit less so the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment Act. But they're also very much about, again, in a way that the EU Green Deal is too, they're also about promoting American dominance within the global economy and about continuing to grow the American economy. To do that through building up new green industries, strength in renewable industries, electric cars, things like this, and to create jobs and to stabilize the foundations of American capitalism and to secure American dominance in the international economy.
Other countries, including South Korea, took up the new Green Deal concept. What about your nation, the UK?
So the UK has seen very limited embrace of the idea of the Green New Deal. There's certainly been much more traction within the Labour Party. There was quite a bit of support for something that looked like a Green New Deal when Jeremy Corbyn was the head of the Labour Party. What we have seen with Keir Starmer in charge of the Labour Party is certainly quite a large-scale plan for transforming the industrial basis of the UK economy, large-scale investment in infrastructure to support decarbonisation and the creation of new jobs in the manufacturing sector. But again, this is shorn of many of the more progressive features of the Green New Deal as it's been discussed more intellectually as a sort of template for green transition. So again, there is no commitment to full employment. There isn't a particularly strong focus on racial justice or equality. The role of the state and of public institutions in shaping the green transition is still relatively limited. So there's some inspiration from the Green New Deal that feeds into those policies, but they're a long way from, I think, the most optimistic and ambitious interpretations of what the Green New Deal would be on the climate left. Now, the Conservative government that are in power, by contrast to the Labour Party, who are currently out of power, they've recently been backpedaling on commitments to net zero. They've expanded licenses for offshore gas exploration, and they're trying to build an electoral coalition going into the next election, which is solidified by a commitment to slow down the transition to net zero and to actually extend the use of fossil fuel energy and extraction in the United Kingdom. So they're moving in a very, very bad direction in terms of climate policy.
Oh dear, the UK goes for the Black New Deal. Well, let's get back to basics. What was the situation behind the first New Deal passed by the Roosevelt administration in the United States in 1933?
The inspiration for the original New Deal was to try and drag the American economy out of the Great Depression, which, following on from the Wall Street crash, had seen very large-scale unemployment in the U.S., complete stagnation of economic dynamism, widespread hunger and destitution. And this was a situation that was also inspiring growing labor militancy and radicalism, and essentially threatened to disrupt the foundations of liberal capitalism in the United States. So the New Deal was an attempt to try and both escape the Depression by introducing new policies to increase the level of production and consumption in the economy, to reboot the level of economic demand, to escape the slump, but also to bring out new institutions and new policies that would try and support working class communities, and that would basically kind of increase the domestic support and political foundations of capitalism to stabilize it and to dampen the threat of socialist and anti-capitalist opposition to the U.S. economic settlement.
But when that sort of floundered, the classic New Deal took a different turn in 1937. In your paper, you write, quote, "The structuralists were surpassed by the newly ascendant Keynesian-inspired spenders who placed greater emphasis on the need for a compensatory fiscal policy rather than structural institutional reform to escape from the Depression," end quote. And this is so important. Instead of changing the institutions that may have bred the Depression, they decided to spend their way out of it. That seems to be the approach again these days, don't you think?
Yes. So the structuralist thinkers had focused on certain problems in the institutional organization of the U.S. economy that they argued were preventing a level of economic demand, of purchasing power for workers that would transition the economy back into a higher growth state and escape the Depression. As Keynes became more influential in the transatlantic economic debate, his ideas were taken up by the U.S. economist Alvin Hansen, who had moved to Harvard University. Hansen had his own diagnosis of the ills of the Depression, what he termed secular stagnation, so a kind of long-term tendency towards stagnating economic growth brought about by a number of sort of longer-term institutional developments. But what we see from sort of 1937 onwards is people aligned with Hansen arguing and drawing on Keynes' ideas to make this argument that what was necessary to escape the Depression was actually a much larger government-backed fiscal policy that would increase the level of spending, generate demand in the economy, and reactivate a growth cycle that would help escape the Depression. So what you see here really is this idea that government spending, fiscal intervention can escape the slump, can reboot the economy into a kind of high production, high consumption equilibrium, and drive economic growth. And what we see in a lot of contemporary Green New Deal discourse is a similar reliance on this, you know, fiscal investment, fiscal spending dynamic to push us through green transition, and a focus on green growth that would run alongside this, while at the same time also being aware of the need to scale back the environmentally intensive forms of consumption, of energy use that have brought us to this very, very dire environmental situation that we're currently in. So the argument I make in my paper is that a lot of Green New Deal thinking essentially borrows this spending fiscal emphasis of the New Deal era and applies it to the context of the climate crisis. But what this neglects is the fact that this Keynesian paradigm that was really sort of solidified during the 1930s is actually very much causally entangled with the deterioration of environmental conditions, with the increased use of fossil fuels in, from the 1940s onwards, in particular, what's often referred to as the Great Acceleration. So there's a deep paradox here in wanting to solve the environmental problem, which in many ways is generated by the excessive consumption imprint of wealthy classes, of Western populations in particular, and the way that that has led to rising carbon emissions and pressures on ecosystems. Wanting to solve that by relying on the very toolkit that actually brought us into this situation, a toolkit that was originally developed to generate high production and high consumption in the context of an economic slump.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from the University of Cambridge is Professor Jeremy Green. We are talking about the Green New Deal movement. Jeremy, you are a specialist in the history and operations of capitalism. Is the Green New Deal just another capitalist ploy, a last-ditch effort to save the system that makes the 1% wealthy?
I don't think that the Green New Deal is a capitalist ploy. I think many of the advocates of the Green New Deal would certainly consider themselves to be staunchly on the left politically. Some of them might even harbour ambitions to move beyond capitalism eventually. But I think many advocates of the Green New Deal see this as a pragmatic and workable way of advancing green transition within the context of the time that's available and the institutional structures that we exist within. I don't think that this is a sort of elite-driven, top-down project. Originally, it emanates, in many cases, from progressive thinkers, from progressive political economists, inspired by some of the progressive connotations of the original New Deal. But what we do see now that these policies, or policies that are mildly derived from the Green New Deal, are being enacted in countries like the United States, is that certainly they are being enacted in a way that reinforces capitalism. So if we look at Biden's policies, it's very, very hard to see anything there that's going to suggest that we're going to move beyond capitalism, that we're going to move towards socialism or some kind of notion of public services, public provision and public abundance. Instead, what we're seeing is a lot of fiscal support for sectors of what we might call green capital, who are investing in things like electric cars, renewable energy, supporting these new forms of green capital in a kind of global race to lead what's really becoming a sort of industrial transformation that is supposed to move us into a decarbonized, or to move us gradually into a more decarbonized economy. So this certainly isn't a sort of anti-capitalist agenda as it's being enacted by these policymakers. But what it is doing is drawing the state back into the economy in ways that are much more pronounced and proactive and strategic than we've seen over recent decades when we've been living under the sort of hegemony of neoliberalism, which tended to emphasize priority of the market as a mechanism for distributing resources and for steering economic development.
Well, I worry when the public is finally beaten into a call for real emergency climate action, the government will say it's broke. The money's all been spent rescuing a staggering economy, transferring zillions of dollars and pounds to giant corporations. Now the cupboard is empty. Is there a limit to the amount of Keynes' magic money for these kind of crises?
So I think that what we've seen in the pandemic and in response to the global financial crisis is that when global elites want to, they can use monetary power with extraordinary flexibility and elasticity. We saw in the pandemic entire economies being put on life support schemes while people were stuck at home and many people were not working. And that has generated a context of very large scales of debt. And what we now have is this inflationary context that's led central banks around the world to raise interest rates to try and tackle inflation. So on the one hand, yes, we have this great amount of flexibility in responding both to the financial crisis and then to the pandemic through using money creation via central banks, using fiscal policy and government deficits to keep up people's incomes when they weren't working, when the economy was in recession. But now that we've moved into this inflationary period, it's much more difficult to use those tools because those tools may well contrast with the imperative of curbing inflation that central banks are now prioritizing. It's difficult to see how we might get through the more kind of radical and rapid form of green transition that we need without some inflation along the way. And in fact, inflation for some sectors of the population, for their wages, would be a very good thing. So we need to think about disaggregating good inflation and bad inflation. Good inflation might be inflation that helps workers, that helps underprivileged groups, and bad inflation is the inflation that hits their living standards disproportionately. But we also need to think about taxation and fiscal policy. And one of the big problems of government policy in recent years is that there's been so much reliance on monetary policy to do the heavy lifting, and that has meant that we've relegated the emphasis on progressive taxation, on redistribution, on funding government programs in ways that are progressive and redistributive and much fairer, rather than just leaving this to undemocratic central banks to intervene and drive these outcomes.
Many New Green Deal proponents focus sharply on preventing disastrous climate change, leaving out destruction of the Amazon, die-offs in the ocean, and general environmental wreckage. I think nature needs a Green New Deal, maybe rights for animals or even rivers. Jeremy Green, what are your thoughts?
So I think you're absolutely right to point to the fact that the Green New Deal, as a kind of emergent paradigm of thought, is primarily focused on the problem of decarbonization. And to some extent, of course, that makes sense because the timeline for decarbonization and for driving down CO2 emissions is the most acute, the most severe in terms of its impact on wider Earth system dynamics. So it does make sense to strategically prioritize decarbonization. But at the same time, we have to recognize that this is a much deeper crisis of the entanglement between capitalism and nature and ecosystems, and that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that we are stressing and straining planetary boundaries across a number of dimensions, not just on the dimension of global warming and emissions. So I think what the Green New Deal often evades is a kind of deeper reckoning with how we think about what the economy is and how it relates to the environment, how it relates to ecosystems. And, of course, that's evidenced by the way that it seeks to sort of repurpose this Keynesian idea of the macroeconomy and use that to work through green transition, while neglecting the fact that, of course, people like Keynes and his contemporaries didn't really think that much about the environmental embeddedness or effects of economic growth. So thinking about rights for nature, thinking about how we foreground the importance of ecosystems, of sustainable coexistence between human society and the natural world, I think this is absolutely vital for a much deeper and more transformative sense of what green transition is that takes us beyond just moving into new forms of industrial modernization, the shift to renewables, the turn to electric vehicles. What we see in the emerging green transition discourse and policy is essentially an attempt to maintain our high production, high consumption lifestyles, but to transfer those onto a renewable energy basis. And I think that really skirts the problem of just how intense the impact of the expansion of our economies, of our lifestyles have been on the environment. We simply cannot continue to live with these ideas of privatized abundance and limitlessness. We need to think much more about forms of planetary stewardship that are about resource conservation and about principles of sufficiency and also resource distribution from the global north to the global south.
In a 2021 paper reviewing Green New Deal and degrowth, Ricardo Mastini, Callis, and Hickel suggest, quote, despite important tensions, there is room for synthesizing Green New Deal and degrowth-minded approaches into a Green New Deal without growth. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting idea. I mean, I think one way that you could think about that is to say that, well, the Green New Deal's emphasis on the importance of the state as an actor, on the value of public involvement, public investment, on goals of equality, on provision of basic services. So these ideas are very present in much of the progressive discussion of the Green New Deal. The problem is that they're often attached to this sort of reified attempt to just reproduce economic growth while not taking seriously enough the environmental consequences of that strategy. I think that the degrowth perspective on the Green New Deal is to say, well, look, we like lots of those points of emphasis and we recognize the need for the state to intervene and to do some of these policies on a big scale. But actually, we need to recognize that some sectors of the economy do need to degrow. Those that are most carbon intensive, those that are most ecologically damaging, do need to be scaled back. But of course, we can think potentially about some form of expansion of areas of economic and social activity which have a much more sustainable foundation. But I think in order to do this, we really do need to kind of break beyond the paradigm of 20th century macroeconomic thought that guides the Green New Deal that, of course, emerged around the time of the New Deal. So I think that we need to combine some of the emphasis of degrowth on scaling back activities and sectors that are particularly catastrophic in terms of carbon emissions, in terms of their environmental imprint, but we also need to connect that to a kind of broader way of understanding how we can concert these changes across the scales of national economies and then also the global economy.
As we wrap up, Jeremy Green, what are you working on these days?
I'm currently working on a new project which examines the relationship between liberal ideas of money and institutions of international money, so thinking about the classical gold standard and Bretton Woods, for example, and the way in which these ideas and institutions of money have been entangled with forms of extractivism and have facilitated production, consumption, fossil fuel use across the 20th century. So what I'm trying to develop here is a way of thinking about the origins of the Great Acceleration and of the Anthropocene through the prism of money as a socio-economic technology. And my hope is that by thinking about this historically and theoretically, that might also provide some clues and prompts for understanding how we might reconfigure money and our systems of money to deal with the problem of green transition and to develop economies, economic systems that are much less reliant on ideas of growth and perpetual expansion.
From the University of Cambridge, we've been speaking with political economy professor Jeremy Green. Find links to his open access paper, Greening Keynes, Productivist Lineages of the Green New Deal, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Jeremy, thank you for helping out our Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you very much for hosting me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.